House Special Committee on Energy. We've got Representative Clayman, Representative Tilton, Representative Rule, Representative Nagyak, and myself, co-chair Representative Culver. On our agenda today, first up, we're going to have a presentation by Duff Mitchell on a renewable energy project, a hydro project that he's trying to get rolling on, privately financed, I understand. And so he'll give us a presentation. And then following that, the next item on your agenda, presentation by David Gillespie. We're going to take that off the agenda. That's not going to happen today. And we're going to substitute Mike Kraft with Alaska Environmental Power. He operates the Delta Wind Farm. So we're kind of hitting on two independent power producers. We're not covering any of that bill that's out there. That'll be another day, another hearing. We're just going to hear from power providers from their perspective as trying to help provide affordable energy for Alaska. So, is there anything else, members of the committee, are good to go? Okay. With that, we'll turn it over to you, Mr. Mitchell. We're online here, I see. We have anybody on our teleconference? No? Okay. And our clerk is ready. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Mitchell. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the Energy Committee for allowing us to present. I'll give you a little bit of background myself on the personal side or the business side. I'm the managing director of Juno Hydropower. We are in the final licensing. We'd like to be in construction next year for a 19.8 megawatt hydropower about 30 miles south of Juno. It's about 8 miles away from the state-owned Snettisham transmission line, and we're looking at providing power for Juneau and providing energy security. Hydropower lasts for 50 years, and we feel that we're the next step for providing a good energy security for our capital city. Today I was going to present really on Alaska independent power producers position and how we see things in Alaska with electrical competition, and how we feel that there's some legislative action needed. I won't go into House Bill 78, but I will give an update on R13002, which just recently came out. This was an RDOC and an RCA, and how that does or does not effect with the legislation that we're looking at. Alaska independent power producers, I'm the executive director. I'm unpaid. It's an uncompensated position. And we kind of formed because, you know, there's a bunch of Alaska Native corporations that want to develop power. There's wind developers. There's private enterprise. We have people that are in the combined heat and power, trying to get hospitals on standalone power so that they can generate electricity and hot water in the hospitals for energy security. And we have Ocean and River Kinetic, Ocean Renewable Power Company, which operates in Maine. Tidal Power is looking at doing that here in Alaska. Interestingly enough, we also have an eclectic group of small hydropowers, transmission, and other people that believe in private enterprise. Here's a picture of our members. We got together because we found that we needed a collective voice. We were independently up against each individual's utility. Utilities have a pretty good voice in the state, and we felt that we needed to form together and have a collective voice as well. So what is an independent power producer? We get asked that question a lot. Here's what FERC's definition is. It's a corporation or person or entity that owns and operates generation of electricity for use by the public that is not electric utility. So an IPP, under FERC's definition, is really anybody that's generating power that's not a utility, not a regulated utility. So IPPs provide a different role than utilities. Utilities provide reliable service, billing, maintenance to the ratepayers by either producing or purchasing the lowest cost power available so that they can provide the best service for their customers. They're usually at a low or no risk situation because they build things and then they pass those rates on to the ratepayer. And of course, their ratepayers want to keep those as low as possible. The IPP role is just a little bit different. We as a developer assume all the risk. We assume the permitting, the financing, the construction, EISs, you know, the ABCs of all the regulations just to get our project up, and then we have to determine whether it's financially feasible to go forward, and then we have to come up with the financing and the construction and all the operating risks that go along with that. So we develop electric generation with private investment and risk. So we have all of the risk, and these development costs are not paid, are paid by investors, not ratepayers. Another interesting thing is these roles are well defined in everywhere in the United States. So some historical background on IPPs, independent power producers. Prior to the U.S. Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, PURPA, and that's a mouthful, in 1978, IPPs were very rare. And the few that existed were seldom able to provide power to utilities. Section 210 under PURPA now requires utilities to purchase energy from IPPs, which qualify, you have to be a qualifying facility, at the utility's avoided cost. And this has allowed IPPs to receive a reasonable price for energy they produce and ensure that energy generated by small producers won't be wasted. PURPA came about from the oil embargo of 73-74. Most of our generation on the East Coast was diesel related. And PURPA was brought forward by, I can't remember his name, I should have it, as a Republican senator from the East Coast, and said, hey, look, we have to get our utilities off of oil. We have to diversify for energy security reasons. And today, that has really opened up IPPs across the country. I want to point out some things why I feel we feel as independent power producers and coming from the private capital side that we need to remove some gridlock in Alaska. And I'm going to go through the seven challenges that we see facing Alaska and why that's producing the high cost of electricity that's affecting our economy and our jobs. Challenge one, Alaska ranks second in the highest electrical costs in America. You can see from this graph the Alaska average cost versus the U.S. average and the percentage differences. We just have, frankly, expensive electricity compared to the rest of the country. And then you compare our rate growth that we've had in the last few years compared to our nation's rate growth. And the slide on the left is from the EIA. And it shows the national average of the annual rate growth and the residential electric price and then the price forecast for 2014 and 2015. But the interesting thing is the green bar is what's the annual rate increase on an average in the nation. The slide next to it shows the Alaska Rail Belt utility recent rate increases. I kept it small so it's not oversized, but you can see there's been some substantial rate increases in the last few years. And this information is from from Alaska Department of Law, and these are the regulatory rate cases in front of the RCA. The challenge number two is our Alaska non-oil economy is electric intensive. You know, mines can be anywhere from 20% to 50% of their mine's operating cost. Alaska seafood processing can be up to 35%. You know, canning and drying and if you have freezing, it's obviously higher in your seafood costs. So everybody's affected by electricity, whether you're a ratepayer or you're an employer. Challenge number three is the high cost of electricity also has social costs in our state. And as legislators, you deal with these. You deal with the community problems and how do we fix those community problems. You know, we have eat or heat dilemmas facing some Alaska communities or families. This year, oil prices have gone down, but in the past, and maybe even this year, people have to decide, do they fill their oil tank up or do they put food on the table, and how do they juggle that balancing act? With high costs of electricity in many of our Alaska rural areas, it's hard to create jobs, and there's a lot of foreclosures. I just received a letter, and it's not just our rural communities. Out of the 50 houses that were sold in Fairbanks in January, 32 were foreclosures. And I got this from one of the commercial real estate folks in Fairbanks. So, you know, electricity costs are a fundamental litmus or a testing stick or whatever you want to call it of your economy. High cost electricity has also created a legacy of dependency on government subsidy programs. And so we have some energy refugees, you know, where people have decided that they need to pick up and move from some higher cost areas to lower cost areas. Challenge number four, it's like anything else. You got a credit card, but there's only so much spending limit on it. You have more wants than what you can afford. And Alaska is no different. And that's not a negative. It's just that we want to do lots of things. And the current financial situation facing our state has even put more scrutiny on some of the larger projects and more scrutiny on some of our dreams and aspirations for some of our projects. You know, if we take our needs and wants, our high cost of power, and then we correlate it with what our potential is, we are really blessed in our state. You know, we have 40% of the U.S.'s untapped hydropower potential within our borders. We have phenomenal wind power on our coastline. We have tidal and wave potential. We have biomass. We have huge amounts of coal reserves. We're blessed with so much resources, and yet we have such a high cost of electricity. And so, we see that as a challenge. Challenge six, Alaska ranks last in IPP competitive power production in our country. We produce less power from IPPs than anybody else in the country. So we rank last. We generate about 4.2% of our power from IPPs. Fire Island makes a chunk of that. Mike Kraft here from Delta Wind Farm. You add all these little IPPs up, and that's the 4.2% of our total energy generation from IPPs. The United States average is 37.4%. Comparatively, China has 6% IPP power production. So in comparison, you know, we have less electrical competition than communist China based on the way we have set up our regulatory regime. We feel that because we have the resources, because we have private capital ready, willing, and able to come in and develop these resources, that we're imploring onto you that we have some regulatory remodeling to do to open us up for investment. This is a report. I just pulled out the slide. I am not vouching for the report. I don't necessarily agree with everything in the report. It's a slide. It had Wells Fargo behind it, so it had some credible sources, but in this report it said that Alaska was last in attracting private capital for clean energy investments. So we have to analyze, why is Alaska lagging in so many metrics? Our state regulations and utility practices, in our opinion, are outdated and discourage competition, competency, and efficiency at the detriment of Alaska ratepayers. Alaska wholesale competition is legislatively and regulatory non-existent. Open access transmission at non-discriminatory rates do not exist. Market forces are non-existent. We also have where, hey, the state has built everything. You know, we don't need to worry about that. We'll just go to Uncle Juno or Uncle Ted and we'll get something built. And that business model isn't a competitive business model, but it has got us to this point. You know, we like the idea where if you take money from the state, you need to pay it back. You know, it's the old business promise where, you know, if you really think you got a good idea and you got to pay it back, then you'll get a banker to justify that. And that's a good feasibility step. We have capital flight. We have native corporations in our state that have invested in energy resources outside our borders rather than investing here inside our state. So we have a capital flight going on. And so we feel that Alaska legislation regulations are anti-competitive, utility-centric rather than market force-centric. And your regulations and legislation, you're going to receive what you incentivize. So challenge 7, regulatory processes and statutes versus our state energy policy and PURPA. Our state energy policy is a great billboard for where we need to go. I mean, it was very well thought out. It encourages private investment and private development in Alaska's energy resources. It says we're going to streamline regulations, we're going to get the state government, federal government out of our way, and we're going to put our people to work. I'm paraphrasing, but it's a very good piece. It was touted. But it was aspirational. And this came up in our docket where some attorneys were arguing with the commission. They said, you don't need to really listen to the state energy policy. It's hand-waving. It's aspirational. If the legislature really wanted you to implement this, they would have provided you direction. And that was a wide open awakening for IPPs because many of us saw we're open for business sign on our state energy policy. We went out, we invested our money and figured, hey, the state's behind us, the state's going to change some things and we're going to go out there and be able to get some things done. And then the reality hits that perhaps that was aspirational language rather than where the RCA was willing to say this is directional and yes, we are open for business. So as we as a collective group have looked into this, we've looked at our state legislation and regulations, and our state regulations really haven't been modernized since 1982 with the RCA with regards to competitive power. We think the RCA is recognizing it, though, because after over $100,000 worth of attorney expense, Alaska Environmental Power and the APA group have got the R13002 docket to be heard. We've got a status update that things may be ruling in our favor. It's not out yet, and I'll get into that in a little bit, but at least we're making some progress. Bottom line, we feel that Alaska ratepayers pay too much with protectionist policies and that are out of sync with delivering the lowest competitive cost for our ratepayers. So I talked a little bit about PURPA before, you know, and I want to just throw out a couple things, key things with PURPA. What's its purpose? You know, Section 210 of PURPA says it is designed to promote the development of alternative energy sources by overcoming the historical reluctance of electric utilities to purchase power from non-traditional facilities. That was came out in 1985. Kind of sounds like Alaska today. Congress directs FERC to promulgate rules requiring utilities to offer the purchase of electricity from qualifying cogeneration and small power production facilities. And FERC's rules shall ensure that the rates for such purchase shall not discriminate against qualifying cogenerators and qualifying small power producers. So each state was given an opportunity to implement PURPA. And so in our instance in 1982, we had the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, which was the forerunner of the RCA, docket 81-U-8135, order 4, effectively stamped out competitive energy development and private capital investments, essentially removing Alaska from market forces. And the argument was is that, yes, we have this PURPA, and yes, we need to implement it, but our utilities are just not sophisticated enough. They can't deal with it. And so we're going to temporarily hold off, even though they said it's theoretically better, we're going to hold off on the implementation of PURPA. And that has been the law. That temporariness has been going on since 1982. We brought this out to the RCA and the R docket, and I think they understand that as well. So you've heard different things about what is the avoided cost. FERC regulations require that states ensure that utilities purchase power from qualifying facilities at a level that equals the utility's avoided costs, unless the parties mutually agree otherwise. In other words, you can make a deal less than your avoided cost. And many IPPs have offered to sell energy at less than the avoided cost. But here's where the trick is with the avoided cost. Alaska is the only state that uses average avoided cost. So if you built a hydropower at the turn of the century in 1917, that power is pretty much zero today. So you portfolio that into your highest cost, which may be 20 cents or 30 cents on diesel, and you come up with an average avoided cost, which is somewhere in the middle. I'm oversimplifying it, but we take an average in Alaska, where federal definitions and most other states are in the incremental avoided cost. Your incremental avoided cost is your last cost. So if you're paying 32 cents for diesel on your last cost, and someone can offer you wind at 12, you're supposed to buy it, because it's displacing that higher cost. And so both PURPA and FERC regulations define that as your incremental costs. So we have this R13002 docket. On January 28th of this year, RCA came out and provided a status report on the docket that AEP, Delta Wind Farm, and Alaska independent power producers and all the many utilities weighed in on. And they said that they were going to take up the avoided cost definition. They said that they were going to look at integration costs. They were going to look at the curtailment of power. And even though AEP asked for an open bidding process and a mediation process, they said that they probably weren't going to look at that. They thought that maybe there was things already in the RCA that could handle that, so they said that they would be not addressing that so much. So RCA said that they were going to rule or come out with some draft proposed amendments on February 11th. And so they said that they would revise and look at revising the definition of avoided cost. They revise the determination of avoided cost rates, revise utilities' obligations to purchase from qualifying facilities, and they would look at a legally enforceable obligation. In PURPA, if you offer lower cost than the highest incremental cost, there is a legal enforceable obligation. It isn't a question of whether you shall purchase it from somebody who can offer you the lowest cost. And that's why we have lower costs in other jurisdictions. They're looking at that, how that would be implemented. There would be also an allocation of integration costs and revise the qualifying facilities interconnection requests. Another thing that they said that they would look at is they would ask utilities to compile avoided cost information. Today, it's very difficult to find out what exactly is the avoided cost of a utility without a lot of forensic accounting. And then you would also modify the standard for QFs under 100 kW. But there's unknowns with this. We've only been given that they're going to address it. We don't know what it's going to say, so there's unknowns and risks with the R13002 docket. The docket was heavily protested by Alaska Utilities, Alaska Power Association, and the RCA filings. The draft RCA language amendments are unknown. They could be effective. They could, or they might not be. We just don't know until the RCA goes through its process. There will be a public comment provided after they release their draft regulations. And then after that comment period, the RCA will decide or not to implement the draft amendments. And statutorily, the RCA has to August 23rd, 2015 to make some decisions on this. Now, one of the things we heard, you know, in the energy forums and whatnot, and in our private conversations with, and I should say the public conversations with RCA commissioners, and there was a recent energy forum roundtable that former Representative Isaacson had in Anchorage in September. And it came real clear that, you know, regulators like to regulate. They don't want to necessarily be the interventionist Supreme Court where they modify what legislators' intent was. And it puts them in an awkward spot where you have them try to articulate or try to figure out what legislators mean. So, you know, there's some value in that legislators legislate, regulators regulate. Legislation establishes Alaska values, and then regulations implement those values. Again, I'm going to bring up the directional versus aspirational. We have smart attorneys. If you're not clear and specific, they will be able to figure a good way out of arguing. And so when it came up, well, how come you're not implementing the state energy policy? There was an attorney on the other side said, well, look, it's aspirational. You are not required to. And since you are not required to, I would dare say that you should not. And so we get into this directional versus aspirational. And so we really feel it's important that we have legislation working to resolve what exactly the legislation want, the legislators want, if there is a will to fix these matters. And then, so do we want require competition, market forces, or should we just continue with the status quo as it's working, as we continue with perhaps more of the same? Now, in our opinion, R13002 will not resolve the Seri Fire Island issue, but legislation will. So I'm not going to get into the merits and or the sections of the Alaska Competitive Energy Act, but I would like to point out that there's many things that the legislation does that the R13002 does not. We have a very narrow focus with R13002. We did not open up many things that ACA does. One thing is that ACA would be the legislative mandate rather than an RCA mandate for wholesale electrical generation. ACA also opens up market forces and moves our statutes from utility-centric to market-centric. It would require the RCA to promote competition consistent with the state energy policy. And as with our state energy policy, it streamlines regulatory proceedings from 2 years, which is a lifetime in private business, down to 1 year, which is still a lifetime in private business when you have banks waiting for you to go to construction, but you're trying to get a power purchase agreement. It establishes clear rules and timely non-discriminatory open access such that everybody pays the same, whether you're a little guy, a big guy, whether you got on 1980 or you're a new guy coming out on 2015, we believe the transmission is like a highway. Everyone should have access to it. It also establishes what reasonable compensation and reasonable integration means. It also provides the RCA the authority to investigate and correct discriminatory and anti-competitive behavior, which they do not have that authority right now. It also limits the types of costs that public utilities can pass on to ratepayers. Right now, if they don't like something and they put a $500,000 legal bill into the issue and they lose, they're able to pass that on to ratepayers. And so they can use legal maneuvering and they get that paid for, or they get that reimbursed through the rates. So we're looking at that. And then one of the most important things, and you heard all this ISO and USO, Transco's, and I'm sure you're going to hear more of it that was at some of the previous testimony. This bill lays our docket doesn't lay the ground rules for that. This does. Because if you have anti-competitive and you have non-discriminatory rules, it doesn't matter what organization you create, they have to play by these rules. And we believe that the legislation embraces and promotes Alaska values. Our state was built on competition. It was built on where you could start from nothing and become something. So I won't go into this. This just helps codify the limited scope of the R docket. And it also provides certainty and credibility and reliability.
Yeah, Mr. Mitchell, let's not get into the independent power producer legislation. Let's skip the next couple slides because it's not germane to what's before us today.
Sure.
And then give us a wrap up if you will.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll take questions after that. And just for the record, Representative Tallarico joined us at 10:20 with his nice short haircut.
This slide here is from the Compete Coalition, and this basically shows what states with restructured electricity markets have lower rates of change. You know, this was compiled between 1997 and 2013. And so, you know, we're showing that rates tend to be lower in all residential, commercial, industrial sectors with restructured electricity markets. And we're not asking for retail competition. Retail consumer choice competition is where, like, you have your AT&T and your Verizon where you can pick and choose. We're looking for wholesale competition. We don't want to destabilize the utilities. We don't want to throw them in uncertainty. We just want to be able to provide them power at the lowest cost. And if we can, we should be able to work a deal. And so wrapping up, you know, these are our members. We're growing. We feel that we got a spot at the table. We want to create some jobs in Alaska. We feel that our state has a lot of promise and a lot of opportunity. And so we're here saying that the glass is half full. And we don't want to just give the state a half a glass of water, but we want to provide a full cheeseburger meal and fries so that we can create some opportunities, power some mines, power some industrial development, open up opportunities for manufacturing, and supply Alaska with the power it so much needs. Anyways, that kind of wraps up my presentation. I apologize. I was under the impression that I should be speaking with APA rather than my personal project.
That's fine. It's I think the issue before the committee is the challenges of independent power producers to access the markets and the infrastructure and be able to sell your power. And we appreciate that that balance and that information. And we'll go to our committee for questions. Okay, Representative Tallarico.
Just a comment. Maybe Mr. Mitchell can help me. I believe you were here. We had a presentation from one of the utilities. It was basically promotion of an ISO, USO, or whatever it was. I had asked the question, and I didn't get a very satisfactory answer, I didn't think, but at least it made people squirm when I asked a very simple question that, due to the nature of our electrical and energy costs in interior Alaska, where people are on the grid, if they go to this particular system, will you guarantee me that the low-cost power producer will be the one who gets to provide that energy into the line, and that goes to the meters of those people that right now pay anywhere from 23 to 27 cents a kilowatt hour with no assistance? You know, nobody qualifies for PCE from the state or anything. What I was told was that wasn't the answer that was supplied, you know. And I'll be honest with you, I'm from the interior, and that's exactly what I'm looking for at this point in time, is the reduced cost. And I just want to say, you brought up a fact that 30 some odd houses out of the 50 that were sold were due to foreclosure. Anything that we can do to reduce costs for those people in the interior makes a huge difference to the future of our economy there. And for the people in my district that live in Bush, Alaska, and even further out down the road system that are in very remote communities, the impact of that cost felt in that hub community just spreads. You know, you can just imagine how that just spreads across to everyone. And just for the committee standpoint, I don't believe I got the answer to the question I asked. You know, I because I just wanted a simple yes or no. And I didn't get that, because I do think there's potential out there that people produce power that can feed it into that grid that's at a more reasonable rate, but is not fully utilized. So I guess all in all is what you're telling me is we need to be able to make that change to steer this a little bit better so that everyone has that opportunity for lower energy rates. That it's my understanding that's not the case. Am I correct?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Talarico, the devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. If you have non-discrimination, you can't use anti-competitive behavior. In other words, I want to block this project out because it's going to displace my higher cost power. And so if you can't use transmission as a tool to prohibit commerce, but you use transmission as a tool to engage commerce, then it will work. In the South, when I say South, Lower 48, and in Canada, generation is separated from transmission. You cannot own transmission assets at 69 kV or more as a utility. You have to spin that off into, you can still own it, but you can't manage it. You have to put it into a revenue-producing subsidiary that you can't control to block or tackle. In Alaska, we have a profound problem because we have city-states or fiefdoms or whatever you want to call, and their fiduciary responsibility is clearly to that certificated area. So if someone wants to wield power from one district to, let's say, your district, there's all these rules and problems in between where their fiduciary responsibility says, I need to extract as much as I can out of this deal for my people, but then it may end up hurting where it's going. Conversely, BC Hydro, the utility in British Columbia, wields power to Mexico. Okay, they can economically wheel that power to Mexico all the way across how many states and into another foreign country. So it's a three-country, multiple utility district transmission. And obviously they're offering the power at a rate that somebody in Mexico is buying it for. So I will say to you that it's a man-made problem, not a technology problem. I think that, and I don't want to get into our bill, but I think that the rules need to be laid first. And then it doesn't matter whether you have an ISO, a USO, or a Transco. One, I do think one of the rules is you got to separate generation transmission. If the utility CEO is on the board of directors for the new transmission company, there's probably going to be influence of how that transmissions work for another player. So I think you need to have separation. And if it is separated, that transmission manager or CEO is going to be trying to fill up that line. His job is to maximize his return and get that filled up, and you'll see some of those problems disappear. And I'm not giving you a straight answer, but I'm telling you it's the devil's in the details in providing maybe a couple of the ground rules that would be necessary to make sure that you get the answer you want.
Thank you.
Representative Rule?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mitchell, has the RCA put out any, prior to this report that's coming out on next week, I guess, have they made any decisions on R13002 before this? I mean, has this been something that's pressure has been applied to them for decisions of this PURPA?
Through the chair, a year ago, Delta Wind Farm, Alaska Environmental Power, who's here, attempted to have and enforce some rules in PURPA for their contract with a local utility. And this case spawned from that. So RCA doesn't take initiatives, they take dockets, and then so this case was over a year old. All the utilities were invited, all the IPPs were invited to present, and they've just given a window of where they're going. It was only a status report on January 28th. They said February 11th that they're going to come out with some proposed rules. But we think they're probably going to be good for the IPPs, but I don't know exactly what all is going to be in the fine tunes of their words. And again, even if they do come out with that, that doesn't mean that it'll be the final rule, because then all the utilities and IPPs will have another shot at the public comments to see how this is. So I don't know what the January 28th was just a verbal. There wasn't anything in writing what the rulings are going to be. It was more they gave a PowerPoint, and it just said that, you know, here's the status.
Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, so I do hear some alignment between the independent power producers and a majority of the rail belt utilities that there needs to be an independent system operator, there needs to be a transmission co-op or transmission entity, if you will. I do see that in your slide 28 that you referenced that's something that, so we do have some common interest there that perhaps we can look for common ground amongst the majority of the utilities and your entity. Of course, we're waiting for a study to be rolled out by the RCA to look at those concepts.
We totally agree on that. We think that it needs to be fixed for the problems that have come out. We feel that we should be able to have a transmission that can wheel power, whether it's our power or utility power. Right. Excess power is just good to use. You don't want it wasted.
Right.
I think we're ready, willing, and able to work with utilities to see that we have, you know, this Transco or ISO. We just feel that the ground rules need to be pretty solid so that we don't just say we're fixing it and it doesn't get fixed. We need to make sure it gets fixed. But I think the utilities are in agreement with that as well.
Thank you. You had another slide that you referenced. I think it was the failure to reach agreement on a power sale agreement for the Phase 2 Fire Island.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I believe it was Golden Valley had an agreement with Siri to buy power FOB Fire Island for, what was it, 9 cents or something?
I think it was 6.3 or 6.5.
But by the time it went through a numerous utility districts, it was 20 cents before it reached Fairbanks, and so it was uneconomical.
That's what I understand.
Is that what you referenced? Do you have any, like, yeah, observation as a case in point for your the issues at independent power producers?
Well, if I was the utilities and I knew that this legislation was pending and I knew that the RDOCA was pending, I don't think I would have used this as the case. I mean, this is a perfect case of why we have a problem. That's our analysis. I think it was very timely for the IPPs that this issue came to the table, but I think that this is not new.
Is there, follow-up on that, is there rate information on how we got from the cost of the production to that other cost, or what costs were built into that rate structure to deliver it to Fairbanks, so that we could look at the numbers and try to drill into seeing how regulations are applied and how some of the issues that, you know, confronting competition for independent power producers or other or moving power around the grid, because for the consumer, when we flip the switch on, we want the cheapest power, not the, well, of course, we want convenience and reliability, and each utility has their issues of being able to balance the loads and have to have their
spinning reserve.
Yeah, spinning reserve and reliability. So are there numbers out there that back up, you know, these rate structures that were developed? Is that proprietary? Is that something that
mostly it is proprietary? Like I said, when we dig into what the utility structures is, they can file a lot of documents that are quote confidential, and they're not there for public discourse. However, we can have Ethan Schutt, the vice president of Siri, sit in his chair, and he might be able to provide, because he's privy. I don't know what his confidentiality agreements are or what he can and cannot say, but he could probably illuminate the issue specifically of how it went from such a low cost to a perhaps three times that cost rate by the time it got to the ultimate utility.
Okay, well, with our next presenter, perhaps we can get into some of those technical issues about putting wind on the grid and what the challenges are. But anything else with Mr. Mitchell? Thank you, and
thank you very much.
I'm sure you'll be around. We'll see you next time.
All right, thanks.
We'll take a brief at ease. We'll set up for the next one. Next presentation. Mike Kraft with Alaska Environmental Power, going to comment on, as an independent power producer, and maybe even touch on some of the issues that were raised, and how it looks from where you sit as an independent power producer and the challenges of marketing energy. So please proceed.
Through the chair, my name is Mike Kraft. I live at 1160 Pickering Drive, Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been there for about 36 years. And I also want to say that I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. My wife and I showed up in Alaska with $16. And through a lot of hard work and a lot of unique opportunities, we were able to build a life for ourselves. And what got me motivated about this was I saw that disappearing for my kids. And in 2007, I was listening to the rhetoric about renewable energy, and I also was seeing the economy. I own a gravel pit. I built lots of subdivisions, homes, and I saw the economy tanking. And so my wife and I had to make a decision about what does our future look like in Alaska, specifically in Fairbanks. And I kind of saw it as an opportunity. You know, the fact that we needed cheaper energy, we needed to do something about our environmental issues in Fairbanks, and we needed to provide some opportunities for our children. And so, of course, I got pretty excited about that and decided I was going to be a wind farmer. And, you know, I did a lot of work. It was all out of my own pocket. We built a small wind farm on the Parks Highway, my wife and I. I called it Windworks 101. It's an $80,000 class. And that turned into a 320-acre site in Delta Junction because we found out that that's where the better wind was. And so we bought, at that time, my tax guy was looking at what I was doing and got interested in it and wanted to become a partner. And when he did, we decided to build a 100 kilowatt turbine. It was the first Northern 100 in the state, serial number 0001. And it was $385,000 for the turbine. It was $175,000 for the power line, $320,000 for the land. And that was all private capital. I took my 13 pieces of heavy equipment out there from my gravel pit, and we built a wind farm. We did a wind study, a 36-month wind study. It showed that we had a viable resource. And when we went to bring that 100-kilowatt turbine online, that's where it got interesting. At that point, we realized we were in trouble. And it came down to the fact that the utility really didn't want our power. And one of the ways they kind of stalled us was they wanted us to do an integration study, because at that point we were ready to put 24 megawatts of power in. We had 16 FAA permits for hazard to navigation. We had those permits. We had the DNR permits. We had done the first U.S. Fish and Wildlife study of a wind farm in Alaska and completed that. Got a great letter from U.S. Fish and Wildlife. The community of Delta Junction was not objecting to the wind farm being there. And so what it came down to was they wanted us to do an integration study. It was $110,000. And they kind of modeled what they wanted to see. And we used some of their contractors. We used their wind data. And when it was all said and done, they really didn't like what it said, because it said that Delta Junction was actually a better place to put a wind farm than Eva Creek was, because they made us use Eva Creek in that equation. And that pretty much got thrown in the trash. Well, at that point in time, I realized I needed some help. And so the Alaska Energy Authority at that time came out with renewable energy grants. And so we applied for one.
You hadn't built this turbine?
We had the 100 kilowatt turbine up.
And you had one up?
We had one up, and we had the seven Sky Streams and Healy up operating.
But you were making no sales at that time?
Well, They finally gave us a contract for the 100 kilowatt turbine, and it was based on the average avoided cost. They stalled us for 6 months on the power line that we paid in advance for. And lo and behold, we got that turbine on there, and we forced them, just through kind of public pressure, to allow us to put that 100-kilowatt turbine online. Sarah Palin's Department of Natural Resources commissioner came down and cut the ribbon on that turbine.
How did you negotiate with that first power sales agreement?
Luck. It had nothing to do with whether we were good for the grid or not. It just came down to, we had the turbine sitting there, and there were a lot of people watching, and I think Golden Valley realized that it would not have been in their public interest or their best interest to, for the public to see how reluctant they were.
How did you arrive at a price? Because
that price
as little as possible, and you're going to want to try to break even on your investment and have a little bit of return on investment.
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think that 100-kilowatt turbine would ever make us a profit. That was never the intent. The intent was to establish the wind regime and the technology. And Golden Valley had actually gone to the RCA prior to this when we first went in there and got what they call a QF2 rate. That's the average of what it cost calculation that they use. And so basically I was competing against Bradley Lakes, Aurora Power Plant downtown, and their diesel plant in North Pole, which at that time averaged about 9 cents a kilowatt hour. And so we accepted that deal just so we could get the thing online. And that's when we decided that we were going to go to the state of Alaska and get the Alaska Energy Authority involved, because we thought it might help us shed some light on what was going on. And we applied for a matching grant, a 50% matching grant, and that's what helped us get the EWT 900 kilowatt online. And because we had the state involved, Golden Valley decided to extend our contract from 100 kW to 1 megawatt. And that turbine actually was the first EWT turbine in the state, and it's now in Kotzebue and Nome. There's two in Nome and two in Kotzebue. And the same thing happened with the EWT.
What's an EWT turbine?
That is a turbine. It's a direct drive turbine. It's out of Holland is where it's manufactured, and it produces 900 kilowatts. It's a 240-foot tower, 160-foot rotor. The generator weighs about 68,000 pounds. It's big. The foundation required 450 truckloads of concrete in one day. So these are big things. And that was quite a boom to the Delta economy. I mean, that kept a lot of guys busy. That turbine, we went with it because it had direct drive. Where we are at, it gets 50 below zero, and it blows at 50 below zero. And so we wanted to stay away from the transmission-driven turbines because they had some inherent problems that we had kind of heard about. And so we thought that this direct drive technology was the way to go. And it took us about a year and a half to get that turbine up to the performance level that was required to be reliable. There were some initial problems with it. They had some issues with the generator and some of the components, like the power converter at the base of the tower was had to be UL listed. The one that they were using in the rest of the world wasn't. So that was part of our problems. Now we are running about a 99% availability. We hit 69% capacity factors in November, December, and January, which is off the charts.
Spill it all the time.
I had an 18-day wind event, which is not unusual for Delta.
Yeah, I know.
And five of those 18 days, I was in the 95% capacity factor range.
Does it have to shut down when they get the big winds?
It does. We had an environmental shutdown for the first time about 3 weeks ago. When the wind exceeds 25 meters per second, which is about 55 miles an hour, the turbines go into what's called a protective mode. So they pitch out of the wind and they just kind of sit there.
Yeah.
And every 3 minutes they check the wind speed, and when it drops below 25 meters for a period of time, the turbines will come back on. And that's one of the problems, you were talking about integration of power, that's one of the problems you run into. If you get into a wind regime where you have these winds like you're having here today in Juneau, for example, if you have a 25 megawatt wind farm, and you're cruising along at full power, and all of a sudden the wind gets too high, you're short.
Drop that load.
You're short 24 megawatts.
Yeah.
And that was what was pointed out in our integration study to Golden Valley, is that Eagle Creek was that kind of wind regime, and Delta Junction was not. And so you want to be careful where you put these things.
Who provided your installation and technical support? Was that the vendor of the equipment, or
I hired Precision Cranes, Fred Kleckendahl out of Fairbanks. We hired Norcon to do the electrical work.
Right, but more the technology on getting the drive and the turbine, I mean, everything working, the generators.
That turbine manufacturer is basically, when you buy a turbine, you're buying up. You get between a 1 and a 3 year warranty on the turbines. So what they'll do is they'll send in what's called an erection crew out, and they'll just be 2 or 3 guys, and then I supplied another 4 guys and the cranes and all the other various equipment that it took to do it. We installed the foundation ourselves, sure, my company, but they send out technicians.
You mentioned what I was getting at was you mentioned that it took us a while to get the fine tune where we weren't you all listed, because you know that's what the utility's going to point out. Well, you're not meeting our specs, and you know we're not going to buy your power till
right.
You know, getting all this was a bug zone.
This was the first turbine to operate at 40 below zero.
And then the frost, is that a problem on the
not in
blades?
Delta? Not in Delta. It's a desert.
Okay. Some places, I think you have to have heaters in Alaska and like the
our black blades.
Yeah. So,
you know, there's lots of various ways to deal with what they call hoar ice.
Okay.
Typically, that happens when you're in a cold event, mm-hmm, and it warms up. The warm air comes in and mm-hmm condenses onto the blades. We don't have that problem in Delta at all. It's so dry there that it has never really been an issue for us.
Would you put more capital at risk and construct more wind power, or are you kind of like?
Well, I have 6 empty foundation holes right now that are dug, and the roads are in, and the permits are in hand. And the EWT, the first time I tried to do this in 2010, GE was going to be a partner with us. Okay, and then since then we went with the direct drive turbines. Now EWT has been watching our SCADA, and for the last year we have run, we've got a great record, 98-99% availability. And it's such a strong wind regime that EWT, the company itself, wants to be an equity investor in this project. That's how strong that wind regime is, right, in Delta. So the answer to your question is we're ready to spend $50 million.
Will you be able to get on the grid with that power?
Well, I'm hoping to. I'm going to wait and see what this RDOCket does, and I understand there's a bill that's being brought forward that might help us. So I am hoping that, yes, we can bring this on the grid. And just for what we did last year with the 2 megawatts that we have online, because after we got the grant, the matching grant for the first 900,
mm-hmm,
we borrowed $2 million and put another $500,000 of our own money with it as a down payment, and we put a second EWT in. And that's where Golden Valley had capped us, was at 2 megawatts.
Okay.
That was the ultimate cap. Last year, we saved Golden Valley Electric Association $1 million. We displaced 300,000 gallons of oil out of North Pole.
Just for
2 megawatts. And it's kind of interesting because it's created some economic opportunities for us that were kind of unforeseen.
Is there data to compare the Delta Wind Farm production, you know, output versus the other sites, Fire Island, Eagle Creek, where you can put this project up against those other and say, if you buy our power or our, you know, we're producing this much energy, you know, just so we have like some data where you can compare what sites the highest production and it would benefit the consumers.
Through the chair, my information, I share it every day with AEA. We have a LIDAR unit out there right now that we're testing for AEA. My information is available to everyone in the state. I've made it available to Kotzebue, Nome, Tok. Anybody that's asked for our data has it.
Do the other ones provide?
No, sir.
No?
It's a secret. Okay. The only thing that I've been able to do is go to the COPA filings and see that Golden Valley Electric Association is not charging itself anything to regulate Eva Creek, but they want to charge me 18 cents. And I have an answer to your question earlier, if you don't mind. You were talking about what the problem was with bringing Fire Island power to Fairbanks. You know, we will power from Bradley Lakes all the way to Fairbanks at a cost of zero. That wind farm, they wanted to charge them, I think it was close to 14 cents. That's the disparity here.
Does that have to do with state investment and the way that Bradley was managed by all the utilities when it was brought online and how it was developed with state funds and the infrastructure? It was kind of cooperative amongst the utilities, and now this is a private, a non-utility player.
To the chair, I can put it this way. Somebody always asks me, well, why'd you do that? And the answer is, 'cause I can. And that's the answer to this. The reason that that 14 cents was put out there was, in my opinion, we buy 70 megawatts of economy cells from GGATCH Electric right now for Fairbanks. That wind power would have competed with that 70 megawatts of economy cells gas power. And it would have been cheaper for Fairbanks. It would have helped our community. And so the competitive nature of bringing 24 megawatts of wind power and competing with the 70 megawatts of economy cells that GGATCH Electric is currently selling us, that was the motivation for killing that wind farm. It was greed.
Okay. Any questions, committee? No? Dave? Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. What was up and running first, Eva Creek or your Delta?
Delta Wind Farm was the first commercial wind farm on the Rail Belt grid.
Has Golden Valley's approach to you changed at all in the last few years? I know they had a change of upper management, and now they save money by using power from Delta. Has that made them more encouraging of your
project? The short answer is no. The upper management change, Mr. Borgeson was the attorney for Golden Valley, and he is now the CEO. He was the attorney at the point in 2010 where we were denied access to the grid. So and Mr. Nordak, the chairman of the board, has been here for 35 years. So really, there hasn't been a lot of change at the top, and the attitude is.
Let's not get into those kind of details.
Certainly not changed.
Anything else, Mr. Wolf?
No.
Okay. For our committee aides, if we can request data from AEA, from the Fire Island Siri folks, the operator there, and Golden Valley, so we can, I'd like to see some charts, you know, where we lay on where is producing, where's the best bang for the buck in wind power in Alaska, so we kind of have a baseline of
Mr. Chair,
what the output is.
The actual answer to that is all three of those wind farms is the best answer, because you're in three different wind regimes. And when it comes to spinning reserve, if you have a wind regime in Delta Junction that's warmer today and Fire Island is not, then there's a balance there. And if it's blowing in Fire Island tomorrow or Eva Creek and I'm not, there's the real answer here. So all three of these wind farms are
right.
Viable.
Well, Reptile Rico would tell you it blows all the time in Healy.
One thing, I'm pretty sure that most Golden Valley customers have probably received a bill and they get an evaluation of all of the power production things, and the best of my recollection, I think Eva Creek produces about 32%.
That's performing
in time.
Yeah. That's performing.
So it's not nearly as big a producer as where Mr. Kraft is in
Delta. Actually, it's better. It produces more power.
Well, it produces more power, but I think less availability, I should say.
Right. Their problem's on the top end.
Yeah, their problem is on the top end with less availability, and he's in an area where his availability is through the roof as far as wind generation goes. I think typically most of these wind farms, they're hoping to get like 28%.
30% is pretty good.
30% is good.
Yeah.
And yours is
well, now my site, though, in the summertime, it drops off. And this is kind of interesting because this also has to do with regulation, integration of power. Our strongest months are actually in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And 85% of our power comes November, December, January, February, and March.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the summertime, when Golden Valley system requirements drop to 100 megawatts instead of 200, it kind of mirrors the consumptive. So.
The location of Delta Junction, because you have coastal areas due south and Summit Pass, and then the interior where you get these big high pressure systems and the low, you get the pressure gradient.
That's exactly what
and
Delta Junction is about.
I'll tell you, and their predictions are very accurate. It is going to be blowing 50 tomorrow, and it is, and you're right on the Tanana River, and it's blowing grit and silt in the summer. It's frequent event.
And so it kind of works well to integrate the power, because when you don't
need
it,
it's good for wind power.
It is. Mm-hmm. And it's created an interesting opportunity for us at Delta, because now we're building 15,000 square foot underground greenhouse in March. And because we have that power now, and we're in a place where there's no property taxes, there's no zoning, we have an opportunity to do a whole project that is based on the fact that we have access to cheap power. So that wind farm doesn't just necessarily represent electrical generation, it represents an economic opportunity for industrial development.
Right.
And that's what we're finding.
Okay, I think we're just about wrapped up here if there's any other further questions in the committee. I appreciate your insights to that, and we'll put that into our knowledge base as we learn more about energy and
thank you for
affordable energy for Alaskans. We have just on our next week, we got meetings both Tuesday and Thursday. So we'll forward the information to your offices, members, and it'll be posted on BASIS this afternoon. Unless there's anything else for the good of the order, we'll be adjourned at 11:25.